Jane Wales. I'm President and CEO of the World Affairs Council. For those of you who are new to the organization, our mission is to engage the public in the exploration of issues and opportunities that transcend borders. And you can, if you ever miss a program and want to catch it, please do look up on our website, which is www.itsyourworld.org, and use our streaming video or streaming audio or podcasts. And that way you can either revisit a show that you've been to or you can see one that you've missed. You also know that, of course, we have a weekly radio show, and this conversation, this program will be on the radio show on KQED-FM, which is on Monday nights. It's Your World at 8 p.m. And I can see that David Ogilvy is recording for tonight, so thank you, David. Before we begin, and while you're taking a minute to turn off your cell phones and anything else that makes a loud noise, let me just mention some upcoming programs. Tomorrow at 6 p.m. at Marines Memorial, that's Friday, June the 12th, we're going to hear from His Excellency Tuomas Hendrik Ilves. I've got to pronounce the President of Estonia correctly. It'll be at Marines Memorial, which is right up the street on Sutter Street here. The next week, on Wednesday the 17th, we will host Dalia Mogahi, who is a senior analyst and executive director at the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies. And she's going to talk about the Gallup's recent series of polls and studies on what motivates Muslims worldwide. That will be here, and it'll be at 6 o'clock on the 17th. Finally, I just want to remind you to make use of your question cards that are on your seats. I'm going to be asking David questions after he makes his remarks, and we'll be integrating the questions that you send up, and I'll be paraphrasing them and using as many as I can. It's now my honor to introduce our distinguished guest. David Sanger is the chief Washington correspondent of the New York Times. In his 27-year career at the Times, he's reported from New York, from Tokyo, and Washington, covering a wide variety of issues surrounding foreign policy, globalization, nuclear proliferation, Asian affairs, and for 8 years, the Bush presidency. Mr. Sanger has twice been a member of the Times reporting team that has won the Pulitzer Prize. In 2004, he was co-recipient of the Weintil Prize for diplomatic reporting for the coverage of Iraq and Korea, or for those two crises. He also won the Aldo Beckman Prize for coverage of the presidency, which is awarded by the White House Correspondents Association. He is the recent author of an absolutely wonderful book that he will speak to tonight, called The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges of American Power. Challenges to American power, I should say. He joins us this evening to talk about the range of issues that book covers, as well as any questions you have on your mind. So please join me in welcoming David Sanger.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Jane, for that. It's wonderful to be back here at the World Affairs Council. I've done a number of events here at the Council over the years and have always ended up, I'm afraid, learning far more from your audiences than I have imparted, and I'm sure tonight will be no different. But I really appreciate all of you coming out here. I thought I would talk a little bit about some of the main themes and some of the main revelations that are in The Inheritance, but I'm going to keep this talk a little bit shorter than how I normally do these, because I've learned when I'm in San Francisco that the audiences are not exactly shy. So I want to make sure that we leave as much time for questions as we possibly can. I wrote The Inheritance because there have been many accounts of course, the war in Iraq during the Bush years, written by some of my colleagues at the time, some of our competitors. There have been some wonderful books from on the ground in Iraq and, of course, from what happened in Washington. But as I was covering the White House, and I was White House correspondent from the end of the Clinton years through to 2000 and the end of 2006, it became clear to me over time that while the Iraq War had many costs, 4,200 American lives tragically lost, thousands more grievously injured, tens or hundreds of thousands of Iraqis killed and injured, one of the least discussed costs, but the one that we're really living with the most now, day to day, has been the opportunity cost. Iraq was a case of what happens in America when you go through a period of enormous strategic distraction. And by saying that it was a distraction, I don't necessarily mean that Iraq was the right war or the wrong war or the right war badly executed, although I think no matter what your political instincts and views of the war and our entry into it were, I think we'd all agree that the execution left a little bit to be desired. But rather that it's so occupied, the attention, the bandwidth of the top level of the U.S. government, that we ignored some much larger threats, much more imminent threats that we're gathering. We're talking about them every day now, whether Iran, after tomorrow's elections, will move forward to a weapons capability or not, whether the North Koreans, who have been just shot off a nuclear test and may well be preparing for another and maybe preparing for more long-range missile tests, whether that was an issue that could have been contained had we addressed it at the right time then. Afghanistan and Pakistan. We run through the gamut of issues of great threats that rose up and great opportunities that we had that we just simply did not exploit. And in the book, I talk about those particularly in regard to China and the environment and energy. But these long-term costs are now becoming clearer to us each and every day. And that is truly the inheritance for Barack Obama. Because when he began to run for office, these all became clear even before the financial crisis took full effect. And you know, a good way to think about how he came to this line of discovery is really to think about what happened the second week of September of last year. This was the week that the Republican National Convention was starting up in St. Paul. All attention was there. It was just when John McCain had named Sarah Palin as his running mate. There was a huge amount of headlines about that. It's usually a week when the candidate for the opposing party sort of lies low. And so early one morning, Barack Obama showed up at the FBI building on the south side of Chicago and got out of his, even at that time, huge motorcade and went upstairs to meet a man who walked into the building completely anonymously. He was the director of national intelligence at the time, Mike McConnell. And they met at the FBI building because it had the only secure federally owned conference room in Chicago. And as we've all learned about Chicago in the weeks that followed that, it's hard to find a secure room in Chicago where your conversations aren't going to be listened to. But they got one. And for an hour and a half, he sat down with Mr. McConnell, who had been quite concerned that the next president of the United States, whoever it was, could not come into office without being up and running on a series of other crises completely unrelated to Iraq that they had to know about, because everybody in the intelligence community was acutely aware of the fact that President Bush had only cursory briefings, as we now all know, about al-Qaeda prior to 9/11. And in fact, the policy recommendations about how to go deal with al-Qaeda were sitting on Condoleezza Rice's desk on September 11th, on the morning of September 11th, waiting for the president to come back from Florida so that they could sit down and have a principal's meeting that would begin to sort out what they were going to do on this subject. I was with the president that morning at the school in Florida, and saw the shock as the government tried to go figure out how it was going to react. And I think McConnell had come to the conclusion that we knew what fuses had been lit, but we didn't know in which order they would go off. And that's turned out to be the case. I mean, I would not have predicted that the North Koreans would act up quite this early in the Obama presidency, and I don't think that the White House had predicted that either. So he ran through the gamut. Many of the briefings that President or then candidate Obama was given that morning were highly predictable: Afghanistan and Pakistan, the spread of terror networks around the world, the Iranian nuclear program. President Obama had already read the 2007 National Intelligence Estimate on Iran with its surprising conclusions, North Korea, future of oil supplies, and a few unpredictable ones. There was a study there about the national security effects of global warming, which had never been included in these kinds of things before. There was one about the national security effects of migration, population migrations. And those two are closely related because, of course, global warming can contribute to significant migrations. What was missing, we now know, a mere 6 or 7, 8 months later, was anything about the national security effects of a global financial crisis. And in fact, by the time Mr. McConnell left office in January and his successor, Denny Blair, took over as the Director of National Intelligence and gave his first threat assessment to Congress early this year, it was interesting. The financial crisis and what effects it could have as it radiates out, particularly in some of the poorest and most volatile countries of the world, had risen to the number one threat that he told Congress about. It was the first time since 9/11 that global terrorism had been displaced. It was also the first time that a global financial crisis was ever included in that list. The two men agreed after an hour and a half of this discussion back and forth, one that also included fairly detailed discussion of the effects of cyber warfare, which is a great concern of Mr. McConnell's and has been the subject, as you've probably seen, of a series that we've started running in the Times about a month and a half ago. When they were all done, they agreed that there was so much to cover that they would sit down and meet again before the election. And it never happened because Lehman Brothers happened, the market fell apart, that became the all-consuming crisis. And the next time that Mr. Obama and Mr. McConnell met in the same room was 3 days after the election. And now that he was president-elect, McConnell was clear and had been cleared by President Bush to tell the next president about what they were doing in each of these areas, not just present the problems, but present the covert programs that were underway, the action plans that were underway. Well, the president took office, of course, on January 20th, was consumed by the financial crisis, which we'll come back to in a bit. But we are now discovering, quite rapidly, as he did, the depth of the cost of the distraction that I spoke of at the beginning. Afghanistan and Pakistan were perhaps the place where this was most obvious. In March of 2002, not long after we had driven the Taliban out of Kabul, and did that with the Northern Alliance, a tribal group from Afghanistan, and about 600 CIA officers, many of whom were on horseback. When was the last time you can remember us winning a war on horseback? President Bush went to the Virginia Military Institute, which is the home of George Marshall. It's where George Marshall was trained 101 years ago. And with all this great Marshall paraphernalia around him and busts of the great general and so forth, he announced that the United States, to consolidate its victory in Afghanistan, would enact a Marshall Plan for Afghanistan. It was not a speech that got a huge amount of publicity in the United States. I don't even think we put it on the front page. But it sure got a lot of publicity in Afghanistan, where people were sort of standing around looking up in the sky for those giant cargo planes to land. Needless to say, they're still looking. The president went back to Washington, and there was no Marshall Plan for Afghanistan. There were a series of disparate programs, some run by AID, some run by non-governmental organizations, but there was no concrete integrated effort to bring one of the poorest countries of the world up to speed at a pace that would make the return of the Taliban unpalatable to many of the people of Afghanistan. And in fact, by 2003, as we were preparing to go into Iraq, Nick Burns, who was the Undersecretary of State in the second Bush term, but at that time it was the U.S. Ambassador to NATO, took a number of NATO ambassadors to Afghanistan to try to convince them to come in and help the U.S. out in a peacekeeping operation there. And when they got to Kabul and they got their briefings, they got the same briefings that I was getting in Washington and others, which was that the Taliban were gone, that they were eviscerated. Not that they had moved 50 miles to the east over the Pakistani border, not that there were elements that were trying to reconstitute with Al-Qaeda, but that they were gone for good. This was the official U.S. military briefing. Well, the result of this kind of thinking was that everybody felt that they were free to move our troops, our hardware, our intelligence capabilities to Iraq. The new Predator planes that rolled off the assembly line not far from here at General Atomics all went to Iraq. And we fundamentally missed the return of the Taliban because we simply weren't on the ground with sufficient forces and weren't in the air with sufficient intelligence assets. For years, while I was covering the White House, the Bush administration denied to me that they had ever bled Afghanistan to pay for Iraq. But when I went back working on a story that actually became the core of the chapters on Afghanistan that you'll see in The Inheritance, a very long story in the Times that I did with my colleague David Rode called How the Good War Went Bad. We went and interviewed every American ambassador who had served in Afghanistan from the time the Taliban fell, every U.S. military commander, most of the CIA chiefs who had been in and out of the area, and they all told us versions of the same story and set it on the record, which was that they had consistently been denied the resources they needed to keep the Taliban from coming back in, and that they had sent one warning after another. But literally, the war had moved on. In fact, one of the CIA officers told us about going into Kabul in 2002 to organize the special forces who he usually used to go run operations against the Taliban, and being told, gee, we'd love to help you, but they just shipped all our arms out to Kuwait. We're on to the next war. We're leaving next week. If we're going to take on the Taliban now, we're going to have to use the fork and knife here on the table because it's basically all we have left. Well, this story was not only limited to Afghanistan. It was, of course, the story across the border in Pakistan, where President Bush convinced himself out of necessity that President Musharraf, who had taken power in a coup in 1999, was not only a budding Democrat, but that he was a great ally in the war on terror. And he was a great ally in the war on terror on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Unfortunately, on Tuesdays and Thursdays, they were still supporting the Taliban. And they were supporting the Taliban for a very specific reason. They didn't think we have staying power. And to this day, the Pakistanis, and particularly the ISI, their intelligence arm, does not believe that we have staying power. Mr. McConnell, the man I referred to who was doing those briefings, found himself just about this time last year in a conference room in Islamabad during one of these emergency sessions where he and the CIA director would run over to Islamabad for the day to try to convince everybody that their biggest threat was from within. It wasn't India, that they needed to focus on the insurgency that was developing in Pakistan, inside Pakistan. And there were two Pakistani two-star generals who were there talking to each other with the American spy chief in the room, not talking to him, but not wanting him to miss the conversation, so they conveniently spoke in English instead of in Urdu. And one of them said to the other, of course we have to support the Taliban, because you know the Americans. You know, they come in just like the British did. They fight for a few years. They discover Afghanistan's impossible, because it's impossible. They pack up, they leave, and when they do that, the Indians are going to move in even more strongly into southern Afghanistan, where they already have a modest diplomatic and road-building presence. And they're going to have us completely surrounded, and they will crush us. And so McConnell came back to Washington, and he ordered up a study within the intelligence community that said, answer the question, is it the policy of the Pakistani government to support the Taliban even while helping us fight the other side of the war? And the answer came back after, you know, due consideration of 24 or 48 hours with a predictable response. And he took this over to the White House, and President Bush gave him a look like, you know, you've been on this job for how long and you've only now figured this out? So it was understood. And yet there was a sense that there was not very much that the White House could do about this. And there was also a sense that admitting it in public would not help the situation. And I think if there's one big change we have gone through in the past 6 months, it has been admitting that when something is not working, it is not working. You've heard Hillary Clinton in her testimony in the Senate describe in quite bald terms what isn't happening with the Pakistani government. Now, we're beginning to see a bit of movement, but we can't tell for how long that's going to last or how effective it will be. There were other threats rising while we were off in Iraq. At the time that we invaded, we were getting ready to invade Iraq in early 2003, the North Koreans threw the inspectors who had been living in the country since 1994 out of North Korea, escorted them to the airport, and in full view of our satellites, went off and pulled out of the cooling ponds where they had been stored the fuel that could be reprocessed into plutonium for 6 or 8 nuclear weapons, on top of the 1 or 2 that they might or might not have built during the first Bush administration, President Bush's father. And we were watching this on satellites, just as the government was. One of the wonders of being a national security reporter in this great high-tech age is that when we come into work in the morning, we also have satellite photographs in front of us. They're commercial photographs that are down to about 1 meter. You can see an awful lot. It's about what the intel community had 7 or 8 or 10 years ago. And you can have a discussion with experts inside and outside the government without having to rely on anything classified. You can email them the photograph and say, gee, what are we looking at? Okay, and in fact, we haven't been done this now for, you know, a few hours yet, because everybody's watching the North Korean nuclear site, testing site, because there's some evidence that they may be preparing to go off and shoot another nuclear test off in coming days or weeks. And so in those months when we were moving our troops to Kuwait, the North Koreans were harvesting this fuel, and everybody knew that as soon as they reprocessed it and stuck it away in mountains, we would never be able to find it again. And we started writing a number of front-page stories that said, looking for the weapons of mass destruction? Check it out on the other side of the world. You know, I know the Times has come under a lot of criticism, some of it deserved, some of it not, in my view, about our coverage in the run-up to the war. But one of the things we did do was make it pretty clear that there was a nuclear threat gathering elsewhere, and the White House was telling us, you're on the wrong story. The much bigger threat is Saddam Hussein. He lives in a worse neighborhood and therefore can destabilize it. The North Koreans live in a neighborhood where they're fundamentally surrounded by our friends, South Korea and Japan, or people who have an interest to make sure that they don't have nuclear weapons, China and Russia, and therefore don't worry about that one as much. Well, they spent the next 5 years trying to get back the nuclear material that we lost track of at that time. And it was pure distraction. The North Koreans looked at what we were doing. They saw that our troops were flowing to the other side of the world. They calculated correctly that the cost of going ahead with this would be zero. And they accomplished the goal. And it's a strong reminder that the cost of an operation like Iraq, the cost of a decision like that, frequently can be what it prevents you from doing elsewhere, like everything else in life. And it wasn't just there. When we went into Iraq, the Iranians across the border had a dozen, two dozen centrifuges spinning, at most. A pilot operation, fundamentally no threat, unless they had other centrifuges hidden elsewhere, which is a significant possibility. By the time President Bush left office on January 20th, they had about 4,500 centrifuges spinning. As of the end of last month, according to the IAEA estimates, they had about 7,000, 5,000 running fully and 2,000 just about to go into service. That is roughly enough to make two weapons worth of material every year. And that may well be where the Iranians are headed. But they may be headed there in a way that is much more subtle than the North Koreans, because the North Koreans are known for many things, but subtlety is not one of them. It's very possible that what the Iranians want is simply a nuclear weapons capability. To actually build the weapon would be to bring a world of hurt down on them. It would be to gather everybody who's uncertain about how much to sanction them, how much to squeeze them. But if you just move to the capability, then you can stay within the strict limits of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and still the rest of the world will know that you have a weapon or that you could make one. The Israelis certainly know, and the news that was in the inheritance when it came out, you may have read this at the time in the Times because we put it in the paper before the book came out, was that in May, June of last year, the Israelis secretly came to the Bush White House and asked for the bunker-busting bombs for the overflight rights over Iraq and for the refueling capability that they would need to take out the Natanz nuclear plant. We never figured out, and I don't think the Bush administration ever figured out, whether they really wanted to do it right away, which I think was unlikely, or whether they simply wanted to get the capability, or whether they wanted to spook the Americans into taking a harder line on the assumption that the next president might not. Whatever their motivations, President Bush, the man who had raised preemption to a level of a doctrine in U.S. policy, said no. He was afraid that it would trigger another Mideast war, and we have a couple of those already. He was concerned that if the U.S. appeared complicit in this, that they would, the Iranians would take it out on American troops who were in Iraq, who are obviously quite vulnerable. And he was concerned most of all that it simply wouldn't work, that it would drive the Iranian program underground. And for those of you who make your way through the book, you'll see it opens with that moment in 2007 when the members of the National Security Team were down in the Situation Room, and they had this 140-page intelligence report on the Iranian nuclear capability dropped on them, with its very controversial conclusion that the Iranians had stopped doing weapons design in 2003, but it's unclear whether they've ever restarted it or not. And so this left a period of enormous confusion where the Israelis were concerned, in part because of that intelligence report, that we would never gather the gumption to confront the Iranians on this nuclear program. Because remember, the theory of the Iraq war was going to be that once we drove Saddam Hussein out, the Iranians and the North Koreans and others would basically call up an 800 number and say, do you guys have a place you'd like us to mail all of these weapons of mass destruction? Didn't happen. And so now we are faced with this much more complex world and much more complex set of threats. I want to just conclude with a little bit about the opportunities that we also have. We missed, during the Iraq time, a focus on China that would have enabled us to get them and us together in both an agreement on carbon fuel emissions and on energy efficiency. I don't know, and none of us know, how close the Chinese would have come to doing that, but I do know that it's going to be harder now that both countries are feeling much more pressed because of the economic crisis than they ever were during the Bush years. Getting Congress to agree to several billion dollars to help the Chinese lower their carbon footprint, I think, would be pretty difficult. Getting the Chinese to agree to steps, these kind of steps, when their own unemployment levels are running much higher than usual, will also be difficult. But it was one of those opportunities that we simply didn't focus on because a war that we thought was going to last 6 months ended up lasting 6 years or more and is still running. It is a great opportunity going forward, as it is with India, as it is with other nations around the world. Whether President Obama is going to be able to go focus on that is a difficult thing to say. The financial crisis may be for him what Iraq was for President Bush, the all-consuming issue that soaks up a huge amount of time. I mean, after all, this man is not only now running the country, he's running General Motors. And, you know, to have to go run the federal bureaucracy and GM at any given moment is probably more than anybody should be asked to do. But we have a situation now where the government has taken on a huge new set of burdens, has promised much more engagement, and we can talk about that a little bit in the Q&A. Some of these engagements will work, some probably won't. You know, I think you've got a better chance with Iran than you do, say, with North Korea. But we're into a fascinating period now as President Obama tries some very different experiments than he had in the Bush era, and tries in some other cases to accelerate some things that President Bush was doing, particularly in Afghanistan and Pakistan, where he has certainly built up not only forces, but our covert operations across the border and our predator strikes and so forth. So this is going to be a wild year. You know, the first 100 days got a huge amount of publicity, but it's the second 100 days that really fascinate me, because that's when you begin to move from broad expressions of goals to actual implementation, and the third 100 days as well. Well, I will end it there and hope that we can spend the rest of the time with your questions. And it looks, Jane, like you already have a couple. So I will stop at that. Thank you.
Well, more than a couple. This questioner asks whether you can discern a worldview from President Obama's statements and actions to date.
Well, it's always a little bit dangerous to impute a worldview to anybody, and particularly to somebody who's only been in for 4 months, but 5 months. But you can certainly see some, the beginnings of some. Engagement is something that he wants to try, in part because it may work, and in part because if it doesn't work, you've at least established to your allies that you have given it a great college try. And if you have to move to sanctions against Iran, or you have to move to confrontation and inspections on the high seas of North Korean ships or whatever, that you have tried everything else. So that, I think, is one thing we can say for sure. Second has been a much greater willingness to admit that the United States has made some huge mistakes. You saw it with the closing of Guantanamo. You saw it with the release of some information, not as much as some reporters would like, about interrogation techniques. You saw it in the Cairo speech when he stood up and said to the Iranians, we've done some terrible things in the past, including running a coup against your government in 1953. Now, it's not a news flash here that we were behind the coup in 1953, but I don't think I've ever heard an American president stand up in front of a Middle Eastern audience and basically admit it. And so that has been quite different. The question that we don't know about President Obama is, at what moment does he come to the conclusion that engagement, openness, transparency doesn't work, and you've got to move on to hard power issues? And I think it's the North Koreans who may well be on their way to trying to be the first experiment in that petri dish.
Tell me, where many of the questions started where you started in your talk, and that's with Pakistan. The Pakistani military is now doing as we've asked. It did crack down on the insurgency, and including in the Swat Valley, but that produced many civilians displaced, many civilians harmed. Refugees. Is this a sustainable strategy?
It doesn't seem sustainable to me if all it is finally getting the Pakistani military to go focus on an insurgency that they should have been focused on for the past 5 or 6 years. Because as we all learned, and as we learned the hard way in Iraq, it's having an effective counterinsurgency strategy that enables you to hold the land that you've taken. So if the Pakistani government can't come back into Swat and into the tribal areas with roads, schools, running water, all those things that we have promised for years that we would go help them do, so that this territory does not become ripe ground for the Taliban to return, then I'm not sure what all this will add up to. But, you know, we've been running some stories in recent days. We had a fascinating one on the front page just yesterday about local Pakistanis who are turning against the Taliban. And, you know, in the economy, we're all looking for cases, you know, where job losses begin to slow and you can begin to imagine how this could turn around. Well, this story is, to my mind, if it gets replicated, the same kind of turning point. The problem with our Pakistan strategy right now is that while the Afghan-Pakistan review that President Obama ran in the first few months of his administration identified eliminating al-Qaeda and its associates, including these insurgents, as the number one priority, we're not on the ground in Pakistan. We're on the ground in Afghanistan, and al-Qaeda doesn't exist in Afghanistan, and the Taliban still have their safe haven in Pakistan. So we need the right combination of them pressing the insurgents from within and us pressing from the border. For those of you who read the New York Times online, and for those of you, bless you all, who read it in the paper edition that is still significantly more profitable, you will read tomorrow morning a story that we have about how we are seeing the first signs that some of al-Qaeda fighters and some mid-level leaders are beginning to bug out of the tribal areas, which is really good news. The really bad news is they're going to Yemen and Somalia, which could well end up opening up some new fronts in our counterterrorism efforts. But, you know, when they move, they're more vulnerable. You know, nobody's ever figured out how to get anybody in the tribal areas. So if, in fact, the pressure that's happening, whether it's Pakistani pressure or the drone attacks or whatever they are, is beginning to force them to look at greener pastures, if you can call going to Somalia and Yemen a vacation, something may well be changing.
Say a little more about the effect, though, of dispersing an insurgency, dispersing a group like Al-Qaeda without disbanding it. What is the ultimate risk? You've got two destinations. How does one go about countering a widely dispersed opponent?
It's difficult, especially because our track record in Somalia is less than brilliant, and Yemen, while it's trying valiantly to hold on, is a pretty close to a failed state itself at this point. It does happen sometimes. I mean, think of Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, the Al-Qaeda forces that moved into Iraq after we invaded, because they weren't there before, but they sure were there after. And eventually they overstayed their welcome and people turned against them. There's always the hope that in Somalia and in Yemen, they don't have the kind of familial loyalties, the kind of tribal ties that they have among the Pashtuns in Pakistan. And so they're operating in a little bit less friendly territory. But it is a more complex problem. And, what you saw happening with the piracy was a reflection of what was happening on the land in Somalia, a completely dysfunctional government that does allow for this kind of safe haven.
Another questioner had read the article to which you refer about the local militias now pressing back on the insurgents, and asked the question of whether, as militias proliferate, whether and as the military continues to demonstrate divided loyalties, and the central political leadership is weak, whether chaos might ensue.
It could well. This is a great, this is the great imponderable of Pakistan, because it's not a natural country. It was created in 1947 in the partition, and there are parts of it that have, don't really naturally hold together. When I was working on the book, I went to Pakistan and spent as much time as I could with the people who protect the nuclear weapons. And there's 20,000 words in the book of inside Pakistan's nuclear weapons complex, which was pretty fascinating, because this is the ultimate fear. I mean, important as Afghanistan is 26 million people who are extraordinarily poor and quite backward and a huge humanitarian issue. Pakistan is 170 million people with over 100 nuclear weapons, and they are building their... adding to their nuclear arsenal faster than any other country on Earth is adding to its. Okay. So the conclusion I come to at the end of these chapters is I believe the Pakistani nuclear arsenal itself is safe even if the country splits apart like that. But I'm less persuaded that the laboratories and the places where they're building the nuclear fuel are necessarily safe. And that's the nightmare scenario. Not only that Pakistan melts down, but that in the course of that we lose track of some of the nuclear weapons. Now, you'll be glad to know that in your generosity here as taxpayers, you have been spending about $100 million over the past few years in a covert American program to help the Pakistanis secure the nuclear weapons. So we thank each and every one of you, because that probably contributed more to your safety than anything you could be doing here. On the other hand, the Pakistanis so distrust us, our great ally, that we can't tell you how the money's been spent, because they won't let us come in and see their nuclear sites, because they believe that at any given moment we have some SEAL team hanging just over the horizon ready to snatch the weapons if the country looks like it's going to split up, as Jane the issue that Jane raised. You could dismiss this as paranoia, or you could say, you know, there's probably a pretty good chance we have some SEAL team hanging just over the horizon. This is the great difficulty, that there's no time, if Pakistan does melt down, that anybody could go to the President of the United States and say, sir, we know where all the Pakistani nuclear weapons and materials are, and we've locked them up, because we don't know where they are, and we don't even know how much there is.
And is this the single highest priority that the administration has with respect to Pakistan?
I sure hope so. It's the one they don't discuss.
The we had several question cards spoke to the Cairo speech of the president, and I think the best way to sum up the inquiry is here we have a situation where an entire generation has come of age looking at the United States in a certain way, perhaps as a threat or as an enemy, and the fundamental question is, can a speech like that, is a speech like that so significant that it can start turning around that point of view? And do you see any evidence of that having happened?
I think it's very hard for a single speech to become that iconic. There have been speeches that have done that. You know, Lincoln's second inaugural, JFK at the Berlin Wall. Maybe in history, depending on how history plays out, people will look back at the Cairo University speech and say that it was such a moment. I'm not certain they will, because the message had to be so spread out in that speech to so many different audiences. There was a message to the Israelis, one they didn't want to hear, about the settlements. There was a message to the Palestinians, one they didn't want to hear, about coming together in a single peaceful government. There was a message to the Iranians, and then a message to the rest of the Arab world. I thought what was most fascinating about the speech was not just the applause lines, and there were several, but the silence, the utter silence that greeted the president when he talked about Sunni on Shia and Shia on Sunni violence, a subject not discussed all that much in the Arab press, and one that clearly made everybody in the room uncomfortable. So I'm not a good enough forecaster of the future to tell you if that speech will be regarded as a turning point or just a valiant effort.
Speaking of forecasting the future, we had some questions about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And one of them spoke to the questions of settlements and asked whether that, how controversial was President Obama's strong statements, or were his strong statements with respect to settlements, and how much are they reflecting a growing consensus?
You know, what's interesting is I think that he was speaking to what is a growing consensus in Israel, but certainly not the view of the current Israeli government, fairly conservative Israeli government. You had to love how this plays out. This is one of these things that can only happen, you know, in Washington, where, of course, the Bush administration had urged the Israelis to stop work on these settlements as well, and there was a lot of paper back and forth. And then the Israelis came out last week after the Cairo speech, and in briefings to us and in comments they made in Jerusalem and elsewhere, said, well, when President Bush said the word freeze, he didn't really mean freeze. He wanted to allow what they call natural growth. There's no evidence we can find among the members, former members of the Bush administration, that in fact there ever had been a signaling to the Israelis that they could go ahead with natural growth. And so we're now in this debate about what freeze means. President Obama's been pretty clear. Freeze means no growth. The Israelis may well end up tying themselves in knots and getting this, making this a central point of argument with the U.S. I suspect they're not going to, because I suspect that the pressure, even at home, is going to build on Prime Minister Netanyahu, to get past this issue. He doesn't want to be seen at odds with his greatest ally. And he remembers well what happened when his own coalition split apart the last time he was in this job. So I suspect they'll be moving on this issue.
Many of the questioners asked about North Korea. One asked whether it was in fact the case that President Bush and his administration was distracted to negotiate with North Korea, or whether it was an affirmative choice not to negotiate with North Korea in the view that to negotiate, to talk, is to somehow to reward bad behavior.
North Korea is the classic case of the difference between the first Bush term and the second Bush term. In the first Bush term, there was certainly a view that it would reward them to talk to them, and that the policy was to try to put so much pressure on them that you would force them over the edge. And that was the explicit excuse. So when the United States confronted the North Koreans with evidence that they had cheated on the 1994 nuclear accord, nobody was thinking about sort of what it is you do if the North Koreans create a crisis after that, because they literally wanted to push them to the wall. By the time the second term came along, Condoleezza Rice and others came to the conclusion this wasn't working. The North Koreans were not collapsing on schedule. Of course, they hadn't collapsed on schedule for Harry Truman or Dwight Eisenhower or John Kennedy or Lyndon Johnson or Richard Nixon or any other American president who was certain that in their term these pesky North Koreans would go away. So by the second term, Chris Hill was hired as the negotiator with North Korea, and bit by bit, he and Secretary Rice turned President Bush 180 degrees in the other direction. But the only way to do this with President Bush, and Chris Hill describes this in the book, was basically by moving the president 5 degrees every few weeks and hoping that by the end of the year he didn't realize that he was in exactly the opposite spot of where he had been when he started. And in fact, when Chris Hill first came in, he was told that when he met the North Koreans, he couldn't shake their hands, he couldn't toast them at a drink, he couldn't sit down and have a meal with them. Ridiculous restrictions that were made up simply to ensure that negotiations didn't work. He sat down and conducted this set of negotiations, and the North Koreans sold us Yongbyon for the second time. That is the nuclear site that they have north of the capital.
But at a higher price.
And they got off the terrorism list and all that. I thought that the most interesting thing you've heard in recent times from the Obama administration is that they are really not interested in buying the same nuclear plant for a third time. Or, as Bob Gates, the defense secretary, put it the other day to a group of reporters, I've already bought that horse twice. And that's why, while the Obama administration says they're willing to sit down and continue the six-party talks, these talks that President Bush started up with China and Japan and South Korea and Russia also at the table, I'm not sure what it is we're all going to discuss if Mr. Obama's not interested in buying this plant again. And that's why it's so critical that the North Korean exports be inspected, whether it is at ports in China or on the high seas, which is why this UN resolution, which will probably be passed tomorrow, is so important, although it's a little bit mushy on the inspection issue. Look, the threat from North Korea is not that they're going to lob a missile at Japan or South Korea or at us, because they value survival more than anything else. So they're not going to send anything out with a return address. The concern is proliferation. You know, the North Korea chapters of the book open up in Syria the night that the Israelis took out a giant building in Syria overnight. And it took us 6 weeks to get through the veil of secrecy about what this was. And it was a nuclear reactor. There's a picture of it in the book that was not yet completed. But the fascinating thing is it was a North Korean nuclear reactor. And we went for 8 years and missed this entirely. The big intel failure of the past few years may not have been that Iraq didn't have weapons of mass destruction. It's that the North Koreans managed to build a nuclear reactor on the other side of the world, 100 miles from the Iraqi border. a place we're watching fairly carefully, and we missed it.
While still on North Korea, some of the questioners have noted that while our focus is on nuclear weapons, there should be a focus on human rights, that there have been extraordinary abuses. And one of the questioners even went so far as to ask whether overthrowing the North Korean leadership is a rational option, whether using military force, another asked about using military force, whether that's a rational option, and if not, why not?
You know, I don't think that a president of the United States who just stood up and apologized to the Iranians for overthrowing a regime in 1953 is then going to turn around and do the same thing in North Korea. Look, overthrowing for regime change purposes, you know, we have a pretty poor history with. Just hasn't worked out usually the way you want it to. Didn't work out in Iraq quite according to the plan that they had laid out, and certainly didn't work out in Iran that way. I could imagine very specific attacks on North Korean nuclear-related facilities. The North Korean human rights situation is awful, but I don't know that there's a military solution to that issue. Until the regime collapses of its own weight. And we've been waiting an awful long time for that. But I agree with you. You know, everything that was said to justify the Iraq invasion, that Saddam keeps prison camps, that he used, you know, awful weapons on his own people, all that, you could say it many more times about the North Koreans. And it tells you something interesting about why it was that we chose one member of the Axis of Evil versus the other. It's just that we managed to choose to overthrow the only member of the Axis of Evil that wasn't actually working on a nuclear weapons program at the time. That takes work.
There are several questions about the degree to which, there were two questions about the degree to which the Chinese have been helpful to us with respect to North Korea. And another question I would just throw in is whether there is a shared view within this administration of the degree to which we can collaborate and the degree to which we can compete with China simultaneously.
Well, on the degree to which they have helped on North Korea, the Obama administration, you know, they were all on the phone to me a few weeks ago after the nuclear test telling me how strong the Chinese were being in responding. And I think this was a little bit of reinventing the wheel. They weren't around for the Chinese response to the 2006, at which point the Bush administration was on the phone to me telling me how cooperative the Chinese were being. In fact, I have a dinner bet with a senior member of the administration about just how far the Chinese will go, and I'm buying dinner if the Chinese are highly, highly cooperative. I think what the Chinese are doing here right now is they're watching a very fine balancing act. They don't want North Korea to have nuclear weapons. They can't stand the dynasty that Kim Jong-il has been the second member of. The whole idea that he would turn the reins of the country over to his 25, 26-year-old son, whose picture, by the way, was hung up on the bulletin boards at the CIA for years when he was being trained at schools in Switzerland in the 1990s. And that's how he got the moniker inside the CIA of the cute leader. Which I always thought was good. It's going to be tough running a country known as the cute leader, don't you think? But the central problem for the Chinese is that while they don't want a nuclear North Korea, they also don't want to collapse North Korea. We would celebrate if North Korea collapsed, I suspect, or many in the United States. Nobody would lose sleep over it. To the Chinese, they get 20 million hungry, ill-educated people pouring over their border because they're not going over the DMZ, which is pretty well armed, and it's a long swim to Japan. So the only place they're going is into China. So while the Chinese may be helpful now, I suspect that if they think that the regime is getting near collapse, they're going to lift their finger off the spigot some.
Speaking of regime collapse, there's a great number of questions about the newspaper industry.
You can't talk about failed states these days without getting around to that sooner or later, right?
One was inspired by the Daily Show with Jon Stewart last night.
For those of you who missed it, he came through our newsroom, and our executive editor gamely answered questions from Jon Stewart's reporter, which was actually pretty funny.
When Bill Keller was asked what's black and white and red all over, Bill Keller's response was, "Well, a newspaper," and the fake reporter said, "No, it's your balance sheet."
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. This questioner really asks about your view of the degree to which the New York Times was vilified by some in the previous administration and by the cable news networks as being kind of a far left or off the mark in some respect. Do you yourself feel it's a balanced newspaper, and do you yourself feel that those targeted attacks have been harmful to the paper itself, to its standing?
Look, the paper is attacked from the left and right every day. We have people on the right who've offered a very familiar critique of the paper and who believe that the New York Times and many other media outlets were cheerleaders for the Obama campaign and so forth. I mean, you've heard all that. We're also attacked quite regularly on the left, you know, that we didn't stop the war in Iraq from happening, that we were insufficient in our reporting, that we swallowed a lot of information about the weapons of mass destruction, and we've admitted to some considerable error, and we ran an awful lot of stories that have been forgotten by history, and that sounds defensive to raise them, that described at great length the Bush administration's plans to invade Iraq. In fact, we're coming up on the July 4th holiday. In July 4th of 2002, we ran the war plan, and we're basically vilified by the right for trying to undercut American national security. We're also the newspaper that revealed the Bush administration's excesses in domestic spying. So we've gotten it from all sides. I actually think that didn't have very much to do with the economic problems that we're facing today. We're facing the crunch that comes from not only a huge economic downturn, but a huge change in the way news is distributed and consumed by people. You know, we have never been read by more people in the world than the New York Times is being read by today. I think we probably are at the peak of our influence to the degree that getting the news out from a fine news organization like the New York Times is, you know, a spread of influence. We've also not figured out how to derive revenue from most of the people who are reading it. And we had just under a billion page views on the paper in November alone, which was a very high viewership month because it was the month of the election. That's a billion. I mean, that's a huge number. But everybody is facing the same problem, which is newspaper circulations are going down, ad revenues are going down even faster, and yet we haven't been able to bring the revenue up fast enough, though it's still growing, on the web side of this to sustain active reporting. So, you know, one of the great moments in that Jon Stewart event the other night was the reporter saying to Bill Keller, don't you think that it's remarkable that everybody's turning to the Huffington Post now and, you know, to many other electronic magazines? And Bill said, you know, the last time I was in Iraq, I missed the Huffington Post bureau. I didn't see where that one was. Or the one in Afghanistan. You know, what we do costs millions of dollars, which is send highly trained professional reporters into extraordinarily difficult places to report and create the currency on which all the rest of this chatter happens. You know, I wrote a story about 2 weeks ago because I've been very busy doing a lot of the GM coverage, about a 31-year-old assistant to the president who has been very active on the auto task force and a really smart, interesting guy but had no experience in the auto industry. It started on the left and right, a huge amount of blogging about this fellow and YouTube on him and so forth and so on, and people claiming you shouldn't have people who are that young working in an industry that they're unfamiliar with, and other people saying, no, we need fresh ideas. But the fact of the matter was that the reporting was the basis of all of this, as it is from that story we were discussing the other day done by the reporters who were in the field to see how people in Afghanistan were beginning to turn against the Taliban. And so my only appeal here is we've got to find an economic basis that allows that kind of reporting to happen. Because if you don't have the reporting, then you don't have this huge rash of opinion. Now, we could probably live with a little bit less opinion in this country. And my view is that, you know, it's wonderful that not everybody needs a printing press anymore. But we've had a vast expansion of opinion so that we're way out of ratio to facts. And, you know, one of my favorite sayings is everybody is entitled to their own opinion, but they are not entitled to their own set of facts. And we need a little more fact collection, and that's what's suffering, as you're seeing newspapers around the country and in this city suffering.
The last question I'm going to put to you from the audience relates to the importance of having journalists asking hard questions, and says, in essence, clearly there were hard questions that weren't asked and answered during the Bush years. And this questioner wants to know, what are the questions that ought to be asked now of the Obama administration during a honeymoon period?
Superb question. Let me just throw out a few. The Obama administration wants us to believe that it is not going to run GM or Citigroup or other companies in which you are all now big investors or owners. Congratulations. Day to day, and yet we are going to bring about the kind of big changes to stop the excesses that brought us to this awful point. I'm not quite sure how you do that. I think at the moment that you are the majority owner of GM, if GM isn't turning out the kind of low carbon impact, high efficiency cars that we've all been talking about for the whole industry, it does raise the question, how does the government of the United States own a company that isn't in the forefront of this? And how do you do that without managing those parts of the economy? So while I can understand for political reasons and economic reasons the desire to return these companies to the market as quickly as you can, you want to return them in a way that you've solved the bigger problem along the way. And I'm not sure they've figured out that balance. On the foreign side, I think the big question has to do with the limits of engagement. It's wonderful to get out and engage countries, and certainly to talk to our enemies, because it's easy to talk to your friends. You know, anybody who's been to a Thanksgiving dinner, though, knows that there are some conversations that are harder to have, right? So the difficulty is, at what point do you draw the line? And so if the Iranians are continuing to build up a nuclear capability while you're having this conversation, at what point do you say, we can't do this anymore while you're still building? Because you'll get to a point when the conversation will become somewhat meaningless. They will have that nuclear capability. Same issues with North Korea. Maybe the same issues with China, though I think the Chinese are likely to be much more amenable to dealing with the Obama administration than they probably were in dealing with the Bush administration. That's going to be a very hard test. You know, we have gone from a country that was a lab experiment in unilateralism to a country that is going to be a lab experiment in the fruits of engagement. And let's face it, some places it's going to work and some places it's not. And figuring out when to know the difference and when to know it at the right moment is going to be the hard part.
Please join me in thanking David Sanger.